Hey guys, my name is JD, and I want to welcome all of you back to GNG's Think Bible podcast. Let me just start today by thanking all of you who are listening to these podcasts and who are participating in the Bible reading plan. Today's podcast is really exciting because we're wrapping up the Old Testament, and we will get ready to launch into the New Testament this week. Now, I know that many of you have mentioned that you are really looking forward to getting to the New Testament, as it so often seems more applicable to us today and because of the stories and teachings about Jesus. But I want to remind everyone that the Old Testament is literally the foundation that Jesus himself stood on. It was the Bible of his time, and he believed that with every fiber of his being, that he was the fulfillment of all the Old Testament prophecy that we've been reading. He believed and taught his followers that he was the eternal king promised to the line of David. So while it may be exciting to finish the Old Testament and to move into the New Testament to study Jesus in depth, the simple fact of the matter is that the Old Testament is the lens we have to use in order to understand Jesus. You'll see in the New Testament that the authors of the different books will allude to or quote from the Old Testament hundreds of times as they attempt to prove that Jesus really is God, that he really came to fulfill Old Testament prophecy, and that he really is the way to salvation and a relationship with God. Now, don't forget, by sharing this podcast to your preferred social media page and by rating and commenting on iTunes, you are helping us get the word out about these podcasts. We would love for as many people as possible to join with us in diving into God's Word, and the more that you guys put it out there, the more you help us with that. So thank you again to all of you who are doing so. As I mentioned before, with today's podcast, we're going to study the last portion of our Old Testament reading, 1st and 2nd Chronicles. Now specifically, we're going to dive into 2nd Chronicles and into the lives of some of the characters that we've been reading about. I want to assess a theme that I think rises up from all the details, dates, names, and information that this book provides. And that theme is this: starting the Christian life strong, but finishing it poorly. You see, I've got to be honest, as I have read the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles, this theme of starting strong but finishing poorly has literally jumped off the page at me. It's consumed a lot of my time and thoughts, and it's been a frequent theme in my journaling as we've gone through these books. And I'll be honest, this topic is becoming very personal for me. Because as a person who often stands in front of so many of you on Sundays, either as a worship leader or a teacher or someone who's just a part of the staff of this church, I'm acutely aware that my example is everything. I open up the news on my computer and almost daily I read about another pastor who has stepped down for some private failure, or some Christian exposed as a fraud, a political leader who's been found involved in shady dealings, or your favorite athlete was just charged with beating his girlfriend. The simple fact is, our culture is full of people who start strong but finish poorly, just like the kings in this book. And to be honest, it's humbling to read about the lives of these kings because it gives me a very strong sense that if these guys, right, these kings who saw God work miracles, who saw spiritual renewal happening under their leadership, if these guys could crumble under the pressure, then it's possible that all of us can. So what was it that got in the way for these guys? What was it that caused so many of these kings to finish poorly? What are the markers of a fall from grace so that we can avoid it? And how can we learn from the example of these men so that we can start strong and finish stronger? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the Apostle Paul is writing to a church in Corinth, and he begins by reviewing the history of the people of Israel. He talks about how God brought them out of slavery and into the promised land, but how they rebelled and fell and were ultimately exiled. And then he says the following. This is 1 Corinthians 10, 11 through 13. He goes like this. These things happened, in other words, the history of Israel. He says, these things happened to them as examples and were written down. In other words, we have the Old Testament in the Bible for this purpose. He says, these things were written down as warnings for us, on whom the culmination of the ages has come. In other words, the generation that got to see Jesus, right? Paul is writing to a generation of people who knew about Jesus. They're well within the lifespan of those people who knew Jesus. And he says, this has come down as a warning to us. The Old Testament and all of its teachings prepared us to know how to live. He goes on to say, so if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall. No temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear, but when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. Simply put, Paul is saying that the whole Old Testament is there for us to review and to read so that we are warned by the behavior of those who went before us. We see what they did well so that we may emulate it, and we see what they did poorly that we may avoid it. He concludes by telling us that we will all face the same temptations that caused each one of these kings to finish poorly. But God is always faithful, and he provides us a way to avoid the same fate if we will take it. So let's dive in, and we're going to learn a little bit from four kings who started well, but finished poorly. Now, at the outset of 2 Chronicles, we are introduced to Solomon, David's son and the new king. And in chapter 1, verse 10 of 2 Chronicles, we read about Solomon's famous request to God, right? Give me wisdom and knowledge that I may lead this people, for who is able to govern this great people of yours? God was pleased with his request and gave Solomon the wisdom that he asked for. And Solomon goes on to build the temple and dedicates it in a passionate prayer that God would always hear the prayers of those people who prayed toward the temple, and that he would remember the hearts of those who long to worship God wherever they are in the world. It's a heady time, and he seems to be doing such a great job. He's truly doing what his father said, walking with God. But in chapters 8 and 9, we see some things that are of concern. In 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse 11, we read that Solomon had married the daughter of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Now, Israelites were not supposed to marry outside of the nation because of the fact that they would worship other gods if they did. And if you read 1 Kings chapter 11, verses 1 through 4, you'll find this statement. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts to their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth, can you imagine, and 300 concubines, and here's the kicker. It says, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of his father David had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely as David his father had done. You see, simply put, Solomon started really well, but he didn't end well. And the fact is, his wives weren't his only problem. In 2 Chronicles chapter 9, verses 28 through 25, and then verse 28, it says this, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. All the kings of the earth sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom that God had put into his heart. And year after year, everyone who came brought a gift, articles of silver and gold and robes and weapons and spices and horses and mules. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for his horses and chariots and 12,000 horses, which he kept in those chariot cities and also with him in Jerusalem. He ruled over all the kings from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. Now, you're probably wondering, if you just read that passage, why does this sound bad? I mean, hey, we live in America, right? We pride ourselves on our successful people and we lift them up as shining examples. But Moses, all the way back in the book of Deuteronomy, had prophesied that the people would one day want a king, and he warned them about what the king should and should not do. Now listen to what Moses had to say in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 through 20. And what you have to understand is he's talking about kings. He said, "When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you and have taken possession of it, and you settle in it, and you say, 'Let us set a king over us like all the nations of around us that are around us,' be sure to appoint over you a king the Lord your God chooses. He must be among your fellow Israelites. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite." So Solomon passes that test right now. Okay, so he's an Israelite, check. All right, verse 16. "The king, moreover, must not acquire a great number of horses for himself." "Or make the people return to Egypt to get more of them. For the Lord has told you, you are not to go back that way again." Solomon had lots of horses and lots of horses from Egypt, as if we read that passage that we just read a second ago. Verse 17, "He must not take many wives." 700 sounds a lot to me. Or his heart will be led astray. "He must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. When he takes the throne of his kingdom, he is to write for himself on a scroll the copy of the law, taken from that of the Levitical priests. It is to be with him, and he is to read it all the days of his life, so that he may learn to revere the Lord his God and follow carefully all the words of this law and the decrees." In other words, the king was literally supposed to walk around with a pocket Bible, scroll, and read it all day, every day, as often as possible, so that he could learn to trust and follow God. And never do we have anywhere recorded in the Bible that Solomon did this. So Moses' words of warning sound a whole lot like Solomon. Solomon did or did not do almost all of the things in this list. Too much wealth, horses from Egypt, many wives, and foreign ones at that, that turned his heart away from God. So when you dig down into it, what really led to Solomon's downfall? Now, I'm going to use an old kind of super Christian word, but that word is idolatry. Idolatry. Now, idolatry is the sin of loving something else more than God, and idols are anything that are more important to us than God. So, obviously, back in the day, there were people who worshipped idol statues of golden calves and birds and animals and, human-looking things, all right? These were idols back in biblical times. But today, the idols that we deal with, the things that can be more important to us than God, can be things like our spouse or our kids or our work or our hobbies. An idol could be money, fame, sex, or drugs. An idol could be our good reputation or having people think well of us. Do you remember the first commandment that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai? Exodus chapter 20, verse 3, it goes like this. First commandment, "You shall have no other gods before me." You see, God told the Israelite people right up front that if they wanted to live life well, God had to be their first love. Now, they could love other things and other people, but God had to be first. And idolatry is simply putting other things before God. And Solomon allowed his wives, his possessions, his wisdom, and his achievements to be more important to him than God. Guys, the same thing will invariably happen to us if we allow the sin of idolatry into our lives. You see, if we want to start strong and finish well for God in this life, then we have to ruthlessly evaluate if there is anything in our lives that has become a higher priority for us than God. You might think about asking yourself the following questions. What is more important to me than spending time with God? Now, if you're able to come up with anything, whether it's family or work or relationships or material things, then that thing has probably become an idol. What is the thing that I want so badly that I'm willing to do something wrong to get it? Or I'm becoming angry and joyless and complaining because I don't have it? If you're able to think of something as an answer to that question, then that thing is probably an idol. Is there anything, except maybe spending time growing in and living out your relationship with God, that you would say that you're addicted to? I mean, it doesn't have to be as dramatic as being addicted to drugs or sex, but if there's something in your life that you are dependent upon, then that thing may very well be an idol for you. You see, Solomon's idols displaced God, and a reign that started in such a promising way came to a destructive end. And if you and I want to finish strong for God, we have to constantly assess our idols and work daily to eradicate them. It isn't so much a matter of do you and I have idols, it's more a matter of what are they. You see, as sinful human beings, we are all prone to idol worship. All right, but those of us who have accepted Jesus as our Savior have been forgiven, and it's now our responsibility to allow the Holy Spirit to help us choose God over those idols every day. You see, Solomon finished poorly because his idols got the better of him. But you and I don't have to. Root out your idols. Figure out what they are. Stay connected to God and choose Him over them, and you'll have a chance to finish well. Now, in 2 Chronicles chapter 14, after a couple of pretty bad kings, we're introduced to a good king named King Asa. And Asa, his run starts awesome. All right, check him out. 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verses 2 through 5. Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of his God. He removed the foreign altars and the high places. He smashed the sacred stones and cut down the Asherah poles. He commanded Judah to seek the Lord, the God of their ancestors, and to obey his laws and commands. He removed the high places and incense altars in every town in Judah, and the kingdom was at peace under him. You see, Asa followed God, and he tried to remove all of the trappings of false idol worship and false god worship from the land. He called the people to live according to God's commands. And at one point, he's even faced with an invading army. This is 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 11, and it says this, "Then Asa called to the Lord his God and said, 'Lord, there is no one like you to help the powerless against the mighty. Help us, Lord, our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against this vast army. Lord, you are our God. Do not let mere mortals prevail against you.' And the Lord answered his prayer, and they won the battle against this invading army." Talk about a guy who started strong. And the Bible indicates that he remained faithful to God and reigned diligently as king for 35 years. But then, in his 36th year as king, the king of northern Israel, Baasha, began to make some aggressive moves, and Asa reached out to the king of Aram, all right, a guy by the name of Ben-Hadad, to create an alliance to protect Judah from northern Israel. He did this instead of consulting with or even praying to God. His little alliance worked, and King Baasha backed off, but God was not pleased that that Asa had chosen to utilize political maneuvering rather than relying upon him. And God sends this prophet, a guy by the name of Hanani, to come to Asa and confront him. And Hanani says to Asa, "Because you relied on the king of Aram and not on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Aram has escaped from your hand. Were not the Cushites and Libyans a mighty army with great numbers of chariots and horsemen? Yet when you relied on the Lord, he delivered them into your hand." That story we just read about a couple minutes ago. "For the eyes of the Lord reigns throughout the earth to strengthen those whose hearts are fully committed to him. You, however, have done a foolish thing, and from now on you will be at war." Asa got so mad that he mistreated Hanani by throwing him in prison. And Asa also began to oppress his people around the same time. And a reign that had started so well was turning south. And near the end of Asa's life, the Bible makes a really fascinating observation. This is 2 Chronicles chapter 16, verses 12 and 13. It says, "In his 39th year of his reign, Asa was afflicted with a disease in his feet. Although his disease was severe," check this out, "even in his illness, he did not seek help from the Lord, but only from his physicians. Then in the 41st year of his reign, Asa died and rested with his ancestors." This is a sad and terrible end for a king who started so well.
So what was the sin that really took him down? For some reason, in the 36th year of being king, Asa gave in to the sin of self-sufficiency. Now, again, for many of us listening, this is just jarring, right? Because we live in a world that constantly berates us with the message that all we need is ourselves, right? We hear motivational speakers that say, with enough hard work and the right attitude, we can all be successful. We hear politicians and athletes tell us that we can be whatever we want to be. And on the surface, that sounds really nice. But the Bible paints a very clear picture that self-sufficiency in God's eyes is very bad. You see, Jesus, in one of his most famous images in the New Testament, says in John chapter 15, verse 5, "I am the vine, you are the branches." All right, so Jesus sets up this image of a vineyard and a vine, and he says, "I'm the vine, and you are the branches." All right, think about a vine. The vine is the pipeline through which all of the nutrients come to the branches so that the branches can bear fruit. And Jesus says, if you remain in me and I in you, you will bear much fruit. But then he says this, and this is just a chillingly honest statement. He says, apart from me, you can do nothing. Jesus says, if you try to be self-sufficient in this life, you will not bear much fruit for God. And we see this bear itself out in Asa's life. Somewhere along the line, he became a person who believed that he was self-sufficient. And all of the fruit of the first 35 years of his ministry died. Do you want to test this? There may be some of you who are saying things like, if I work hard and I'm persistent, I can do whatever I want, whether God helps me out or not. Let me just ask you a couple of questions. Number one, who gave you the ability to work hard? Number two, who allowed you to be healthy and strong enough to do the work that you need to do? Number three, who created you with the intelligence you have to do the things that you do so that you can succeed? Number four, who allowed you to come into this world at this time and in this country so that you have the opportunities to succeed in ways that so many around the globe don't? You see, guys, at the end of the day, God made us who we are and placed us where we are. We don't live without Him. We don't continue to breathe without Him. We don't have the intelligence or physical capacities to be successful unless He has given them to us. So self-sufficiency is a sin. Because when we're self-sufficient, we arrogantly assume that everything we have and do can happen because we make it happen. It's buying into that myth of the self-made man. Look at Asa. He was so committed to believing that he could be self-sufficient that he refused to pray when he got sick and chose to put all of his faith in his doctors. It didn't work out very well. Guys, an attitude of self-sufficiency will get us every time. When we think that we can be successful in this life by doing things our way, we will invariably be heading toward a fall. You see, our hearts are self-deceptive. We lie to ourselves, and we have a natural tendency to believe the best when we look at us and the worst when we look at others. We have to flip that script and remember that we are headed for failure unless we trust God and rely on His guidance. Now, in 2 Chronicles chapter 24, we learn about another king, King Joash. Now, he was 7 years old when he became king, and he had a high priest that took a great interest in him, a guy by the name of Jehoiada. And in fact, the second sentence of chapter 24 tells us how critically important Jehoiada was to Joash. 2 Chronicles 24:2 says, "Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord," this is important, "all the years of Jehoiada the priest." Now, see, that's interesting. So as long as Jehoiada was alive and well, Joash did well. He led well, he repaired the temple, he got things back up to speed, and he led the kingdom and the people generally pretty well. He was a good king. But then Jehoiada died, and the Bible tells us of Joash's almost immediate downfall. After the death of Jehoiada, the officials of Judah came and paid homage to the king, and he listened to them. They abandoned the temple of the Lord, the God of their ancestors, and worshipped Asherah poles and idols. Because of their guilt, God's anger came on Judah and Jerusalem. Although he sent prophets to the people to bring them back to him, and though they testified against them, they would not listen. In other words, these advisors came to the king after Jehoiada died. He picked some new people to advise him, and they encouraged him to lead the country in a different spiritual direction than Jehoiada had them going. They fluffed up the king with a bunch of flattery, and he did what they told him to do. And he ultimately went on to order the death of Jehoiada's son, Zechariah, because Zechariah came and confronted him about what he was doing. Ultimately, Joash was assassinated by his own officials, another king who started well and ended poorly. But what was it that really caused his downfall? I believe that it was his choice to live on borrowed faith. He was living on borrowed faith. You see, all those years he trusted in Jehoiada and he did what Jehoiada said. Now, Jehoiada had an active and powerful relationship with God and he helped the king do what was right. But Joash never actually developed that same kind of faith. He never truly developed a love for God or a desire to serve him from his own heart. Guys, if we don't develop our own faith and strength of faith, the same thing will happen to us. Let me ask you a couple questions. Do you call yourself a Christian just because your parents do? Or do you go to church simply because a friend or a spouse or a loved one does, but don't really dig deeper into it yourself? I mean, do you attend church but not really do anything beyond that? Guys, if we do those things, or if we consider ourselves a Christian because our family's Christian, but we don't really do anything with it, then we're at risk of living on a borrowed faith that will not sustain us when the challenges and temptations of life hit us. We have to know and be committed to our relationship with Christ in order to be strong when we are faced with the choice to do life our own way rather than God's. Now, the final king that I want to cover quickly is King Uzziah. And you find his story in 2 Chronicles chapter 26. And in verses 4 and 5 of that chapter, we're told that King Uzziah did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father Amaziah had done. He sought God during the days of Zechariah, who instructed him in the fear of God. As long as he sought the Lord, God gave him success. And if you read chapter 26, you see King Uzziah winning battles against Israel's enemies and completing building projects, and agricultural growth is happening in the kingdom. Everything seems to be going well. But then you read verse 16. But after Uzziah became powerful, his pride led to his downfall. He was unfaithful to the Lord his God and entered into the temple of the Lord to burn incense on the altar of incense. Now, guys, you have to kind of know some stuff about the Old Testament to get this reference here, but it was the job of the priest to burn incense before God. Nowhere in the Old Testament was a king given the right to do this. His behavior was in direct violation to God's law. And he was unrepentant. When he was confronted about it, he went on a rage fest against the priest that tried to stop him. And during this event, he ultimately broke out in leprosy as a result of his behavior, a disease which ultimately killed him. Simply put, it was King Uzziah's pride and arrogance that cost him his life. Throughout the Bible, we are warned never to give in to a prideful attitude. Proverbs 16, verse 18, a very famous verse in the Bible, goes like this: pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. And in King Uzziah's case, it most certainly did. You see, pride is that attitude which tells us that we can live life our way and do what we want rather than trusting or relying upon God. It is self-centeredness at its core. Ultimately, there is no way King Uzziah would have thought to walk into the temple and light up the incense altar unless he believed that his way of doing religion was right, regardless of what God said. So instead of submitting himself to God's way of doing things, he determined that his thoughts on how to honor God were better than God's. He trusted his own beliefs rather than God's clear instructions. It's something that all of us are prone to do. And we have to root out pride and arrogance from our lives in order to ensure that we don't fall and finish poorly. Guys, I know this has been a really quick review of four good kings who started well but ended terribly. And I know that we've covered a lot, but I want to recap really quickly. The sins that ultimately helped to take these four guys down were the following. Number one, idolatry. Number two, self-sufficiency. Number three, living on borrowed faith. And number four, pride and arrogance. Guys, all of these sins can be found in our lives. Every single one of us, we're prone to them. But all of these sins can derail us. In fact, all of these sins will derail us and cause us to finish poorly unless we take our struggles with them to God and ask for His help in rooting them out of our lives. And ultimately, the antidote for these kinds of sins and attitudes is to begin building our life around their opposite. So, number one, rather than idolatry, we need to put God above everything. And by everything, I mean everything. God over your spouse and your kids and your job and over your wants and desires and material possessions, God must be first, and we have to build our lives that way. Number two, in order to fight the battle against the sin of self-sufficiency, we have to recognize that we aren't self-sufficient and seek God in every situation. Martin Luther, the famous reformer, is said to have made the comment that he was so busy and so overrun with stuff to do that he couldn't accomplish it unless he spent 3 hours a day in prayer. Make that your mantra. You can't do it on your own, so don't try. Martin Luther's example was, I have to go to God because if I don't go to God, I won't be able to accomplish everything on my plate, and we can't either. We have to know that and understand it and live a God-dependent life. Number three, instead of living on a borrowed faith, we have to build our faith by diving deeply into scripture and prayer and self-reflection and spiritual disciplines. We have to learn about God and know more about Him daily. Frequently just digging into our relationship with Him, growing with Him, learning about Him through others and through our own experiences. We have to make understanding God and loving God and living our lives with God our highest priority. And number four, instead of living a life of pride and arrogance, we have to humbly accept that this is God's world. We're just living in it. It's His story, and He has the right to do with us and this world whatever He chooses. Rather than trying to force our wishes upon Him, we have to focus on trying to live out the story that He has for us. Now, guys, this has been really fun, and I, like many of you, am excited about jumping into the New Testament. But I think it's been a blast to take some time to just consider the lives of these Old Testament kings and the lessons that we can learn from them. Because, guys, I believe with all my heart, none of us wants to finish poorly. None of us wants to flame out in our relationship with God. We don't want to start strong and end bad. But it's an intentional choice on a daily basis to fight against the kinds of sins that cause our downfall, and to do everything within our power to seek God and Him first above everything, so that we might honor Him with our lives and not just start strong, but finish even stronger. Until next time, guys, think biblically, think logically, and think honestly.